Production. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we've seen the cracks emerge in Babylon, we are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it'll be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen, is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are destined to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you to the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is June 5th, 2011, Sunday, and Bill Fink is with us for the 8th installment of the Traitors series. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello. Praise Yahweh.
Absolutely. Praise Yahweh. And just to do a brief recap, we spent seven shows, I think seven necessary shows, on how Alger Hiss was definitely a communist. Everybody who had the opportunity to know or who should have known or was in a position to know did indeed know, and they didn't care because, you know, they were all communists themselves. Everybody in the AAA, the Agricultural Administration, seems the Congress pretty much knew. Rosenfeld knew, Truman knew, Henry Wallace knew. Everybody at every step of the way knew that Alger Hiss was a communist, and they just didn't care because they were part of the same communist Jewish conspiracy.
Well, absolutely. It's they had to know. Roosevelt was told at least three, four times that Alger Hiss was a communist, and he just laughed it off.
Because he was one himself. Of course he knows.
Well, we've definitely seen over the past 7 weeks that Alger Hiss, even though he was an Anglo, I have no reason that I found to think he was anything but an Anglo. I have no reason to think that he was a Jew. He was still a communist. He was probably wrapped up in the idealistic view of communism that the Jewish media portrayed after the Bolshevik Revolution, having deceived at least one, probably two or three generations of Americans. And I think that that's Harry Hopkins, too. And I can't be positive about that, but because the information I have about Hopkins, it's hard to find really in-depth information of or anything that he actually wrote. But it's definitely true of Alger Hiss.
Sorry, go on.
I think that these people became disillusioned with capitalism, not realizing that capitalism was really Jewish. They became disillusioned with capitalism and saw communism as the alternative to that. They also hated fascism, which again indicates to me that even though fascism was the correct response to Jewish capitalism, and it was the response in Europe to Jewish capitalism, that they in Western Europe, well, these men were led around by the nose by the Jewish media because the Jews wanted them to hate fascism.
We would say that they were well-meaning white people for the most part who were inclined to want justice, and they saw the excesses of Jewish capitalism as indicative of the problems of free market enterprise, not knowing that there's a difference, and the Jewish capitalists pushed them into the arms of the Jewish communists who offered them justice and fairness and equal distribution and everybody will be happy and it'll be a great worker's paradise.
Well, that's the way I see it. That's the way I see it with a whole bunch of these idealists that came out of the 19-teens and 20s and 30s.
And they were turned off by what they saw as fascism's infringement on civil liberties, where socialism claimed to have a monopoly on excess liberty by virtue of favoring a stateless, classless, anarchistic society where there would be no government to infringe your rights.
Well, right, and fascism really had no infringement on civil liberties. It only had an infringement on Jewish corruption and perversion and the Jewish theft of the wealth of nations.
That's one thing I noticed. People talk about freedom, but what do they really mean? To a Jew, freedom means he's free to engage in usury, prostitution, and white slavery and all kinds of evil. It doesn't mean
yes, that is freedom to a Jew. And when we think freedom, we think economic independence and personal liberty. The Jew thinks the right to be a pervert and walk down Fifth Avenue in a G-string.
Where we think about freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, and they try and claim that pornography is freedom of expression, yet it has no artistic value, it has no cultural merit. It's basically just delivering up obscenity for white people who are feeding at the trough of Jewish capitalism or communism to eat it up, like slop.
Well, right. It's obvious that it destroys culture. It's anti-cultural. Well. Anyway, to get back to the subject matter, the leftist Bolsheviks in this nation, until this very day, have tried to obscure and diminish Hiss's role in the policy making of the Roosevelt administration, while at the same time they run cover for Hiss's crimes. And to me, that it basically never makes us think of the fact that we are living with the results of Hiss's, the crimes of Alger Hiss and the crimes of Harry Dexter White to this day. These men were communists. They had every sympathy in assisting world communism, and these men set up the World Bank, the IMF, and the United Nations. All three of those organizations were originally founded by communists. There's founding documents were written by communists, that their government, that their governance was created by communists, that there's no doubt that they're communist organizations, and we still have to live with them today. Why are we living with the results of the perpetrations of these Bolsheviks?
Because we deserve
it. Well, yeah, we deserve it, and there's a higher spiritual plane on which we will find the reasons for that. But here in the real world, if we don't take religion and our relationship with God into consideration, we see that we're living with the results, with the works of these communists in American government, only because we're still bickering over whether or not they were guilty and haven't looked at the final product. Because we're still bickering over whether or not they were guilty. We've allowed the Marxist Jews in our own nation to run cover for these crimes for 70 years. It's incredible. This great and long-running Bolshevik propaganda effort concerning Hiss's guilt and Harry Dexter White's guilt and all these other Soviet agents and what they did in the Roosevelt administration, it helps keep hidden from the general public in America the fact that we are already a communist nation. That fate was sealed in 1913 when we placed ourselves under the yoke of the Jewish banking cartel.
They'd prefer we spend 8 more decades debating whether or not these people were innocent or guilty when we should be dealing with the issues that it's an accomplished fact what they've achieved. They were certainly guilty. We can see that on face value. We need to be discussing how could they have done what they've done.
It should be examined as a matter of fact that these men were communists, and the things that they committed us to have to be undone. But we never get to that point because nobody will ever admit that these men definitely were communists so that we could assess the situation at the next level. It doesn't happen. And it doesn't happen because in reality, Talmudic capitalism and Talmudic communism, Jewish capitalism, Jewish communism, they're both the products of the Jews, and they're truly one and the same economic system, which are designed so that a handful of Jewish banking families can achieve world domination. And the veracity of the statement can certainly be established from even a precursory glimpse of our history from the 1930s through the 1950s. And Adolf Hitler stood against this. He revealed it to the world in Mein Kampf, and therefore Germany had to be destroyed. The Jewish bankers must really be laughing at the millions of ignorant white men and women who have fallen for the entirely false capitalist versus communist paradigm, which these bankers have used to deceive and enslave the entire world practically.
And we should be discussing that instead of, oh, was Alger Hiss really innocent or was he guilty? Do you think he should have been convicted? We should be discussing the regime that allowed him to remain in his position for decades, and the regime that did a whitewash for him, and the media that covered for him and still covers for him. We shouldn't be discussing was he innocent or was he guilty.
There's no doubt. Well, I'd like to turn your attention to Harry Hopkins. I really don't think that Harry Hopkins was a spy for the Soviets. in the sense of being an agent passing off secret documents, as we see in part in Alger Hiss. All right, Alger Hiss had he's both a spy for the Soviets, where he's passing off documents, and he's an agent of the Soviets, where he's steering American policy in the favor of the Soviet Union. Right. So there's two prongs to the Alger Hiss fork. I don't think that Harry Hopkins is really a spy in that sense. Rather, I think that Harry Hopkins was purposely doing the bidding of the New York plutocrats, to whom he, and we will see this when we review his personal life, to whom he was deeply indebted. And he was doing that as part of his official function. The New York bankers happened to be very sympathetic to the Soviets for different reasons, for reasons other than just pure ideology or idealistic ideology, that they really owned the Soviets. The New York bankers created the Soviet Union. And Harry Hopkins, while he was a true progressive socialist, in other words, a Western Bolshevik, right? But to him, he was being an idealist and what he considered to be a progressive. He was indebted to these bankers, and he did their bidding. This is my perception. For reasons of his own naive ideology, that it was convenient for him to also do their bidding.
We would say that Harry Hopkins was an ideological dupe.
Well, right. I think that's what he was first, yes. And that's my opinion formulated from what I have seen of his background. And of course, I could be wrong if I took the time to learn more. There's some people that claim he was a spy and an agent. I don't think he was a spy or an agent. We'll get into that a little later. It's the actual evidence of Hopkins as an actual agent or of Hopkins spying is very thin and almost non-existent compared to Harry Dexter White and Alger Hiss, who were both definitely outright spies and agents. Hopkins could do what he did in the Roosevelt administration naturally and did not have to be a spy. Hopkins believed in the socialist cause, and being indebted to the plutocrats, he did their bidding in the Roosevelt White House. And he had a great amount of influence with Roosevelt, and I believe he was answering to the people, to the certain Wall Street bankers. Hopkins did at one point manage a purge of many of the more conservative Democrats from the Roosevelt administration, which I also believe paved the way where it could be padded with pinkos, where it could be, you know, where communists could simply be, the staff could be padded with communists more easily. Let's talk about the background of this Harry Hopkins. Harry Hopkins was born in Sioux City, Iowa. He was the child of devout Methodist parents who taught him the social gospel. He attended Grinnell College and graduated in 1912 and took a job with Christo Dora House. That would mean Gift of Christ, right? Which was a social settlement in New York City's Lower East Side ghetto. Let me say that the Lower East Side in the early 1900s was very Jewish. In the spring of 1913, he accepted a position with the New York Association for Improving the Condition of the Poor. I'm reading from the Conservapedia article on Harry Hopkins. As a friendly visitor and superintendent of the Employment Bureau, in October 1913, Harry Hopkins married Ethel Gross. She was another social worker. And the couple eventually had three sons, David, Robert, and Stephen.
Did you mention the social gospel? You said something about a social gospel.
Yes. That was what the religion that his Methodist parents bred him up in.
That was incredibly progressive, wasn't it?
Yes.
Since they were involved in the prohibition movement, they wanted the ending of what they called unequal wealth distribution. It was basically a communism masquerading as Christianity.
Well, right. Exactly. It was an early form of communism masquerading as Christianity. In 1915, New York City's mayor, John Puroy Mitchell, appointed Hopkins executive secretary of the Bureau of Child Welfare, which administered pensions to mothers with dependent children. So we see that Harry Hopkins was basically a social worker. That's his background. He's steeped in communist ideology, and he's a social worker. He's no different than all of those billions of 60s bleeding heart liberal hippie social workers that the American universities began to turn out, right? In 1917, with the nation's entry into World War I, Hopkins became the American Red Cross Director of Civilian Relief, and to his credit, he actually tried to enlist in the Army. He was turned down for health reasons. Eventually, the Gulf Division of the Red Cross merged with the Southwestern Division, and Hopkins, headquartered now in Atlanta, was appointed General Manager in 1921. Hopkins helped draft a charter for the American Association of Social Workers and was elected its president in 1923. In 1922, Hopkins returned to New York City, where he became general director of the New York Tuberculosis Association. During his tenure, the agency grew enormously and absorbed the New York Heart Association. So we see that he's a competent bureaucrat in addition to being a social worker, right? When the Great Depression hit, New York State Governor Franklin D. Roosevelt called on Hopkins to run the first state relief organization in the nation, the Temporary Emergency Relief Administration, TERRA. Hopkins and Eleanor Roosevelt began a long friendship which strengthened his role in relief programs. And these are two peas in a pod ideologically, right? Now, here is where I think Hopkins is compromised, and this will be pretty easy to see, right? Hopkins married, as a young man, a fellow welfare worker. That was that Ethel Gross. They had three sons. In 1930, his wife filed suit against him for divorce in New York State, the charge being infidelity. She secured the divorce and an order for the payment of $5,000 a year in alimony. That was a ton of money at that time, right? Hopkins was making $10,000 a year at the time. Shortly after and $10,000 a year in 1930 is a lot of money.
It may not seem like a lot, but I'm sure that was the equivalent of probably multiple dozens of people. That's an entire year's wage for.
Well, let me say, in 1978, I was loading trucks on the docks in Bayonne, New Jersey, and I wasn't making $10,000 a year.
Okay, depending how you measure it, if you go by the consumer price index, it's $128,000. If you go by the unskilled wage average, it's $404,000. And if you go by relative share of GDP, it's $1.55 million.
Right.
So he was making a boatload of money as a bureaucrat.
Is a lot of money in 1930, and he's a petty bureaucrat, basically. Shortly after the divorce, he took a second wife. He became WPA administrator at a salary of $10,000 a year. Marquise W. Childs, in an article in the Saturday Evening Post of April 19th and 26th, 1941, said that Hopkins was hard-pressed for funds under the circumstances and was having a difficult time meeting the alimony payments to his first wife. To cure this situation, social workers were brought together to raise a fund of $5,000 a year to take care of Hopkins' alimony. A number of small, salaried little social welfare workers were assessed to pay Hopkins, in other words, they were extorted, right? To pay Hopkins' obligation to support his children.
So if I come in off the street looking for a job, he says, I'll hire you, but you got to kick back 10% of each paycheck to me because I have alimony to make.
Well, this certainly seems to me like they're painting it in graceful terms, but it seems to me like some sort of union-run extortion racket or something. That these social workers were brought together to raise a fund of $5,000 a year to take care of Hopkins' alimony. A number of small, salaried little social welfare workers were assessed to pay Hopkins' obligation to support his children. In theory, the money was collected to pay him for lectures. The arrangement went on for 2 years. Then in January 1936, his salary was raised to $12,000, and the welfare workers were relieved of the burden of Hopkins' alimony. Now that seems to me like he's a man of very poor character, because these social welfare workers are probably making a fifth of what he's making or a third of what he's making. I'm sure that they're not making anywhere near $10,000 a year. And he's leeching off them to pay for his own infidelity is basically what he's doing. And that's Harry Hopkins.
Well,
that's his character.
Bill, the average wage in 1930 was approximately $1,400 a year. That was the average salary for a basic American worker.
Well, right, and social workers are typically paid less. They were typically very low paid, I mean, at least through the 70s. I don't know about today, but I'm sure they don't make a whole lot of money today.
Well, I've seen a lot of government jobs out there. One of them said they wanted a FEMA corruption and waste manager to make sure that no money is being lost to corruption and waste, and they started $148,000 a year.
That's a management position, though.
Yeah, and I'm sure that if you tried to report that as corruption and waste, they wouldn't see it that way.
Right. Okay, Childs relates in that same article that during those WPA days, Hopkins, who was so pressed for funds, was, with the men around him, playing poker with losses so stiff they ran $500 to $600 an evening, and that he found the time and the means to spend weekends in the homes of wealthy friends and to make frequent visits to the racetracks at Saratoga, Pimlico, and Warrington. Life magazine has printed much the same stories about him. And let me say that I picked two articles for tonight on the basic life of Harry Hopkins. The other one is from DocumentTalks.com. This one's from Conservapedia. And they're both saying primarily the same things. And it's I think that they're both pretty objective. According to Mr. Felix Belair in an article in Life magazine, Postmaster General Walker, John D. Hertz, and other millionaire friends raised a purse to pay Hopkins $5,000 a year as head of Franklin D. Roosevelt's library at Hyde Park, that this would be basically a no-show.
Oh, and do you know much about John D. Hertz?
Shopping.
John D. Hertz was the Jew who I believe founded the Hertz Corporation in Chicago, renting out cars. He was born in Austria-Hungary.
When the Lend-Lease Act was voted, the president arranged, and this is, we're getting under Roosevelt now, right? A $10,000 a year salary for Hopkins under the Lend-Lease program. During this period, Tom Beck, the head of Crowell Collier Publishing Company, began paying Hopkins $5,000 apiece for 7 or 8 articles in the American magazine over a period of several years for articles written in Hopkins' name. That's another gratuity, basically.
So he's basically getting now salary under the Lend-Lease program, salary from his job as a social worker, this purse that his friends have raised. So he's pulling in about $30,000 to $40,000 a year.
Well, he's doing a lot better, right? He's probably moved on from his New York social worker job to work for Roosevelt in the Lend-Lease administration, but he's making several other salaries that are basically gifts. In the meantime, he had moved into the White House, where he enjoyed the additional privilege of free board and lodging.
So he's doing pretty well, living in the White House.
Hopkins basically moved into the White House in 1941, yes. His second wife had died, and his daughter, by this marriage, lived with him in the White House. When Hopkins and his third wife later moved to Georgetown, his daughter, after remaining with them a while, went back to the White House. Mrs. Roosevelt writes how she fretted about the lonely life of this child and spoke to Hopkins about it. He said to her, "That's totally unimportant. The only thing that is important is to win the war." He found plenty of time, however, to pursue at intervals his favorite forms of diversions in the nightclubs of New York and Washington. So it seems to me that Harry Hopkins was a man of very low character, and he was a man that needed money, and certain New York millionaire businessmen, Jewish New York millionaire businessmen, made sure that he got the money he needed. He was indebted to them now.
Well,
in March 1933, Roosevelt summoned Hopkins to Washington as a federal...
I just wanted to comment on that. When you said he's a man of low character who needs a lot of money, if he were trying to get a security clearance today and that was the sort of person he was, they'd probably turn him away. You would hope they would anyway, because that's the sort of person that he's going to become a spy or an asset for a foreign government.
Well, right. But he was engaged in infidelity with his first wife. He divorced her. The outcome of the divorce proceedings put him in dire straits, in a need for money, and certain New York millionaires made sure he had money. And to me, it's pretty clear that he was placed into the Roosevelt White House, and he was a supporter of Roosevelt's when Roosevelt was governor of New York. He was an employee of Roosevelt's when Roosevelt. So he had a relationship with Roosevelt while he was indebted to these plutocrats.
Sorry, go on.
And it seems to me a perfect fit. They found a man that had been compromised and could be compromised further.
Conservapedia does not come right out and say that he was an asset, but Wikipedia actually says that Hopkins routinely gave reports to the NKVD and that he was listed as a source and an agent, someone who could be relied upon.
Well, right, and that's disputed. But that's disputed, and it's a complicated situation that I'll get into a little later, right?
All right.
In March 1933, Roosevelt summoned Hopkins to Washington as Federal Relief Administrator. Convinced that paid work was psychologically more valuable than cash handouts, the dole, which is what he'd been receiving, Hopkins sought to and I don't know why they even feel it important. They don't cite a source, but for Hopkins's own frame of mind or the behavior or the attitude that they're attributing to him, right?
Sure, and it seems that Hopkins would have been fine with accepting handouts for the rest of his life.
Well, he had been for several years now. Hopkins sought to continue and expand the Hoover administration's work relief programs, especially the FERA, Federal Emergency Relief Administration, which he supervised, the Civil Works Administration, which he supervised. The CWA developed a reputation very quickly as a leaf-raking agency. Hopkins told the president, "I've got $4 million at work, but for God's sake, don't ask me what they're doing." That sounds like the typical county job, right, in a lot of places. Hopkins feuded with Harold L. Ickes. That this man is the father of the Harold Ickes from the Clinton administration, who ran a rival program.
If this FERA and TERRA is supposed to be a temporary emergency relief administration, and then it folded into Social Security, it's obviously not very temporary.
Well, TERRA was actually a New York State agency. That was when Roosevelt was the governor of New York, right?
Okay. But none of these agencies have ever gone away, really. They've just morphed and changed. Right.
It seems to me that we had plenty of federal employment agencies all throughout the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. I mean, the old CETA program. It's they keep coming back, right? Hopkins feuded with Harold L. Ickes, who ran a rival program, the PWA, which created jobs by hiring private contractors who hired the workers. The PWA did not require applicants to be unemployed or on relief. FERA, the largest program from 33 to 35, was a continuation of Hoover's relief program and involved giving money to localities to operate work relief. CWA was similar but focused on short-term projects like maintenance work that left little visible impact. The FERA is a model for the stimulus package passed by Congress in 2009. They never really go away, right? FERA was replaced in 1935 by the much bigger and more important agency that Hopkins ran, the WPA, or Work Progress Administration. In cooperation with state and local government, WPA hired men and some women directly into federal jobs from local relief roles. The WPA was dramatically new because it operated on its own. It selected projects with the cooperation of local and state government, but operated them with its own staff and budget. Hopkins estimated that 25 million people got their living from Works Progress Administration alone. That's probably a sixth of the country at that time, right? Upon being purged from the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, communist lawyer Lee Pressman was immediately hired back into the government by Hopkins, who apparently had little regard for the law. According to Pressman, Hopkins told him, the first time you tell me I can't do what I want to do, you're fired. I'm going to decide what I think has to be done, and it's up to you to see to it that it's legal. So yes, Hopkins had little regard for the law, right? Hopkins started programs for the National Youth Administration and for artists and writers. He and Eleanor Roosevelt worked together to publicize and defend New Deal relief programs, communist relief programs. He was concerned with rural areas, but more and more focused on cities and the Great Depression. Critics charged that his WPA, with 2 million men employed who voted 90% Democratic, was the first national political machine. If Hopkins had plans to becoming president, they were shattered in 1940 by the Hatch Act, which made it illegal to use the WPA for political purposes. Roosevelt biographer John Flynn observed, "It became a part of Mr. Hopkins' WPA organization to learn how many of the down and out had enough devotion to Franklin D. Roosevelt to be entitled to eat." It sounds like every picture the Jews paint about Hitler's brown shirts can really be spoken of the WPA, right? Hopkins' performances in WPA became such that he had to leave that position after the 1938 elections were over and was appointed Secretary of Commerce. Significantly, one old associate who moved with Hopkins into his new world was David K. Niles, who had become his chief political advisor and campaign strategist. A little more than a year and a half later, Hopkins moved to the White House as a close presidential confidant, advisor, and resident, paid a salary that was never authorized by Congress. He didn't have a real he was a political advisor and campaign strategist. That's not supposed to be a government job. That's a party job. But he was paid a salary, and Congress never authorized it, and it kept happening. Which shows you a little about regard for the law in the Roosevelt administration, right? During the war years, Hopkins acted as FDR's chief emissary to British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and Soviet leader Joseph Stalin. This is why I think that Hopkins didn't have to be a spy, right? He went right to the sources. He didn't have to be a spy. He everything that he did, all of the policy that he advocated, it was right out in the open. He didn't have to hide behind a cabinet job. He didn't have a cabinet job. He didn't have a legitimate government job. He slept in the White House, and he was Roosevelt's campaign strategist.
So he's a bomb.
Yes. He's the Rasputin of the Roosevelt administration. During the war years, Hopkins acted as FDR's chief emissary to British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and Soviet leader Joseph Stalin. He's not a paid diplomat.
Do we know just how close he was to Eleanor Roosevelt?
Well, I don't know how close anybody would want to get to Eleanor Roosevelt. I think if she was in California and I was in Britain, that'd be a little too close. Roosevelt trusted Hopkins more than he trusted the State Department. Now remember, it's the Conservapedia article didn't really go into any relationship Roosevelt may have had with Hopkins in New York, but they are old New York political buddies, right? Roosevelt was running for governor of New York, and Hopkins was a supporter and a helper in that, right? Visiting Britain in spring 1941, Hopkins had a major voice in making policy for the vast $50 billion Lend-Lease program, which we saw that Alger Hiss also had a big hand in, right? Especially regarding military supplies, first for Britain, and then, after the German invasion in June 1941, the Soviet Union as well. Hopkins promoted an aggressive war against Germany and successfully urged Roosevelt to use the Navy to protect convoys before the U.S. entered the war in December 1941. Roosevelt brought him along as an advisor to his meetings with Churchill at the Cairo Conference, Tehran Conference, Casablanca Conference. He was a firm supporter of China, which received Lend-Lease aid for its military and air force. Hopkins wielded more diplomatic power than the entire State Department. Hopkins helped identify and sponsor numerous potential leaders, including, in other words, he was picking out Jews, right? Including Dwight D. Eisenhower. He continued to live in the White House and saw the president more often than any other advisor. Although Hopkins's health, always poor, was steadily declining, Roosevelt sent him on additional trips to Europe in 1945. He attended the Yalta Conference in February. He tried to resign after Roosevelt died, but President Harry S. Truman, recognizing the value of his services, sent him on one more mission to Moscow. Hopkins died in New York City in January 1946, succumbing to a long and debilitating battle with stomach cancer. In June 1941, Moscow learned of President Roosevelt's decision to send Hopkins to the Kremlin in order to negotiate Lend-Lease. For a number of days, no pertinent information from the Soviet embassy in Washington was available. Consequently, the Kremlin readied for a stiff and prolonged bargaining session. Molotov was appointed chairman of the committee, which was to determine in advance how far the USSR might have to go in yielding to American demands. Well, they didn't have to take one step. This included the right of Americans to inspection of Lend-Lease distribution on Russian soil, the admission of American military advisors into Soviet lines. The Soviet Union was willing to give concessions for mining manganese ore, as well as special privileges in the Baku and Volga oil fields. The Soviet Union was even prepared to give a solemn pledge to maintain freedom of speech and freedom of religion. You could have any religion you want as long as it's none. Shortly before Hopkins' arrival in Molotov informed Mikoyan, Vasilensky, Trenin, and Bogolyubov that a man at the very highest level of the Roosevelt administration notified the Soviet espionage officers that Mr. Hopkins will demand no concessions whatsoever, the sole wish of Mr. Hopkins. Molotov assured the Tavarishes, it is to ask nothing and give everything. What he wants is to keep us in the fighting. That is all. Mr. Hopkins is completely on our side and may be trusted absolutely. Hopkins said of Stalin, quote, it is ridiculous to think of Stalin as a communist. He is a Russian nationalist.
How can he be a Russian nationalist when he's a Jew from Georgia?
Well, right. That's absolutely incredible that Hopkins, I don't know if his idealism blinded him completely, or if the New York millionaire Jewish friends that he had blinded him completely.
The Soviet intelligence apparatus has several departments that are tasked with doing nothing other than making sure foreign dignitaries are kept intoxicated and basically plastered from the moment they get off the plane to the moment they get back in their home country. So I'm sure when he got off the plane in Moscow or the boat in Arkhangelsk or Vladivostok or however it was that he got there, I'm sure that, you know, they wined him and dined him. And they probably, you know, arranged for him to have some liaison with some Russian woman, because I'm sure that they were well informed that he was a philanderer.
Despite the protests of military officials, Hopkins demanded that the American government give the Soviet Union a large amount of uranium as part of the Lend-Lease program. But why don't we just give them New York and half of Florida too? On a diplomatic trip to the Soviet Union in 1945, he shunned the American position of free elections for Poland and told Stalin that America's goal was to actually have a post-war Poland that the Soviet Union was comfortable with, so that they could use it for vacation homes and young blonde girls. Earlier, when a Soviet government official defected, Hopkins unsuccessfully urged Roosevelt to return the man to the USSR, even though he knew that it would mean the man's certain death. So Hopkins would have given Iowa to the Russians. He'd have forget it. I mean, this guy's totally blinded. Roosevelt biographer John T. Flynn remarked of Hopkins, men of high intellectual and spiritual caliber soon make themselves disagreeable to rulers who want abject subservience in their subalterns. They soon find the atmosphere of the court repulsive. They either depart or are dismissed. In the end, the only ones who remain are men of the type of Hopkins, low moral character. One by one, the abler men with some sense of personal dignity who are unequal to the role of sycophant drifted away. The palace guard that survived were such men as Harry Hopkins, David Niles, and Henry Wallace, men who were not interested in policy, but only in discerning Roosevelt's pet mental drifts so that they could sell him out to the Soviets. Zam's title. Recent scholarship has concluded that the Venona Project code name, Zam's title, English translation, deputy, is Harry Hopkins. Edward Mark, historian at the United States Air Force Academy, builds a case that if Zam's title is Henry Wallace, as many people assumed, that then Agent 19 at the Trident Conference, another Soviet codename, is Harry Hopkins. Mark argues on the basis of a close reading of the attendance records of the Trident Conference and other evidence that he located, that the most likely deputy, or Zam's title, was Wallace, and source number 19 was Hopkins. Source number 19 was very, very highly placed, in as much as he was asked to join a private conversation with President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill. Source number 19 reported on a private conversation he had with Roosevelt and Churchill during the just-ended Trident Conference of the two Allied powers in Washington. Source number 19 reported on Churchill's views on why a 1943 Anglo-American invasion of continental Europe was inadvisable. The message also reported that Zam's title supported a second front and that it appeared that Roosevelt had been keeping Zam's title in the dark about important military decisions. The message from the New York KGB office to Moscow is signed by the KGB illegal officer, Ishak Akhmarov. It states, 19 reports that Kapitan, meaning Roosevelt, and Kaban, meaning Churchill, that was their code names to the KGB, during conversations in the country, meaning the USA, invited 19 to join them and Zam's title, who's probably Henry Wallace. In the 1960s, Akhmarov professed at a secret meeting of Soviet intelligence officers that Harry Hopkins was the most important of all Soviet wartime agents in the United States. I said that Harry Hopkins wasn't the traditional spy in the sense of passing secret documents to the Soviets. But what he was doing was he wasn't a government official. And he was just speaking openly with the people that he had license to speak openly to. He didn't have to be passing them secrets to be giving them information. And that's my attitude. I don't think that Hopkins would have seen himself as a spy. He was just basically a man whose entire sympathies lied with the Soviet Union and communism. And it was very natural for him, not being a government official, but having all the benefits of being a government official, to just talk to the enemy, to the communists as if they were his best friends and tell them everything that he knew.
He wasn't a government official under an oath to keep things secret, so he just figured, why can't I share all these details with my comrades?
Right, absolutely. The Harry Hopkins situation is very unique in that he wasn't he's a campaign manager for Roosevelt, just happens to live in the White House with him. That's incredible.
So Roosevelt basically made a mockery of the presidency.
Yes, he did. I mean, it's a huge security breach for a wartime president to be allowed to live with his campaign manager. And this campaign manager knows everything that's going on in the White House, and he's not a government official.
And
he doesn't
communist.
Have any of the obligations and responsibilities tied to holding a government job.
And you can't really charge him with espionage because he's never sworn an oath to keep all these things secret and classified. He doesn't have a security clearance, but he's privy to secure information.
Right. The Hopkins situation, I think, is very unique for those reasons. And that doesn't mean that he's any less treacherous than any of the others. In fact, he's much more treacherous. He's basically a loose cannon. He has all of the He has all of the benefits of and luxuries of being of working for the government, and none of the responsibilities or obligations or oaths that go along with that. He's being used by Roosevelt in a diplomatic capacity, and he's not a diplomat. It's a really strange situation that should have never been allowed to occur. But Roosevelt, what was basically a dictator installed by plutocrats who just flaunted the law time and again.
And when the Supreme Court tried to rein him in, he threatened to have some of them forcibly retired and then packed the court with judges that would do whatever he said.
Right. Now I have a quote here from Claremont.org, that this is a political philosophy website. Basically, that they say even more than Harry White, Harry Hopkins was assuredly a major league agent. I don't think he was an agent in the true sense of the word. He was a fellow traveler occupying the White House.
He wasn't on their payroll, and he wasn't answering to a handler.
Author Robert Sherwood once wrote that Hopkins was generally regarded as a sinister figure, a backstairs intriguer, an Iowan combination of Machiavelli, Svengali, and Rasputin. This from a puff biographer. They consider Sherwood a puff biographer. So that's some of the things that are said about Hopkins in various circles. Now, DocumentsTalk.com, they write about the smearing of Harry Hopkins as a Soviet agent and are highly critical of the 1990 book written by Christopher Andrew and Oleg Gordievsky, who was a former high-level KGB officer who defected to the West in 1985. Claiming that they are smearing him, they say that suddenly, that in 1985 there was the sudden claim in this book that Hopkins was the most important of all Soviet wartime agents in the United States, entitled KGB, The Inside Story of Its Operations from Lenin to Gorbachev, and based on Gordievsky's recollections of a lecture he heard when he was a KGB intelligence trainee. The book described how Ishak Akhmarov, the former Soviet illegal resident in the United States during World War II, had intimated to young KGB trainees that he had secret meetings with Hopkins. These meetings allegedly began before Hopkins made his first trip to Moscow in 1941. That they try to defuse this data, and they try to use the that they argue with Edward Mark and the Venona documents, and some of this makes sense, but it really what. Because of the difference in Hopkins's position, I think, a lot of the things that they're fighting against that in this Documents Talk article, they're basically just tilting at windmills because of the language that's used. I don't think Hopkins was an agent in the traditional sense of the word, but he was in a unique position to fully cooperate with the communists, and he was a communist at heart. He didn't have to be an agent, as we explained, and that's I think cause for a lot of the confusion. That there are several other sources and on the internet that show that Harry Hopkins or that testify that Harry Hopkins did indeed pass plenty of information to the Soviets, that they would have considered him a source from that perspective. But he wasn't an agent. There's a big difference.
So he wasn't meeting with somebody outside the embassy in D.C. from the Soviet embassy on a daily basis.
No, he was getting a plane and going right over there or getting on whatever and going right to their offices in wide open because he was Roosevelt's emissary to these people. He didn't have to sneak around because he wasn't a State Department employee.
There was no one really to hold him accountable.
Right. There was no one to hold him accountable, and there was no law governing anything he did.
All right. Would you like me to begin with Owen Lattimore?
Yes.
Now, Owen Lattimore is important in understanding in regards to what happened to China because he was an advisor to Chiang Kai-shek. And from the article, Owen Lattimore was a U.S. political advisor to Chiang Kai-shek in 1941. After Pearl Harbor, he became Director of Pacific Operations for the United States Office of War Information. According to a unanimous report of the Senate Judiciary Committee, he was also, from some time beginning in the 1930s, a conscious, articulate instrument of the Soviet conspiracy, end quote. And the Office of War Information was basically an agency created during World War II to help with propaganda and information, although it also was engaged in broadcasting communist propaganda subversive to U.S. interests and American foreign policy. They had over 6,000 agents scattered across the world, and they spent almost $100 million broadcasting anti-fascist propaganda throughout the 4 years that America was involved in World War II, officially involved, that is to say. And a lot of the propaganda they broadcast was basically revolutionary communist propaganda, and Owen Lattimore was at the heart of that. And to get back to him, in the years between 1928 and 1945, Owen Lattimore wrote 8 books about Asia and China. In his first book, Desert Road to Turkestan, Lattimore wrote, "I should be inclined to say that a very strong case can be made out for the Soviet position," end quote. In a later book, Manchuria, Cradle of Conflict, in 1935, he wrote, "Russia appears to be the only nation of the modern world that is young enough to have men of destiny. It creates its Lenin and its Stalin. Russia, more than China, and more than any nation of the West, is launched upon a career of growth," end quote. China, which was to become the victim of this communist growth, is characterized by such adjectives as aggressive and expansionist. Bill, have you ever heard of China being aggressive or expansionist in the 20s or 30s? That's absolutely ridiculous, isn't it?
Right.
Since they were being attacked by Japan.
Yeah, you know, it's I have here Bankrolling the Bolshevik Revolution, and a quote from Owen Lattimore that says that the problem with China was how to allow them to fall without making it look as if the United States had pushed them.
And he's the man who's the top policy advisor to Chiang Kai-shek. He's the best we could come up with. But I guess for the purpose at hand, which was making them fall without looking like we pushed them, he was the best they could come up with. But for the purpose of helping Chiang Kai-shek save China, it all depends on your perspective then, doesn't it? Whether he's the right man for the job.
That quote was from None Dare Call It Conspiracy by Gary Allen.
All right. In 1934, in The Mongols of Manchuria, Lattimore put forward the idea that Xinjiang, Mongolia, and Manchuria might be made into a separate empire under Soviet influence. And he claims the people of Manchuria are not Chinese at all, but Mongolian. Just like the Soviets claim the Macedonians are Macedonian Greeks instead of South Slavs living in Macedonia. In 1935, in his Manchuria, Cradle of Conflict, Lattimore wrote that the Soviet Union, China, and Japan all had ambitions in Manchuria, but that the Soviet Union had more right there than China or Japan. It was in this book that he pictured China as an aggressor in Manchuria. In 1942, Lattimore wrote a foreign policy report, September 1, 1942, called Asia in a New World Order, after the Pearl Harbor attack. Japan had taken Manchuria. Lattimore altered his picture of Manchuria now. He abandoned his old line that Manchuria was not Chinese but Mongolian, asserting that it was 95% Chinese and that it was a mistake, merely because the country is called Manchuria, to think that the people are not Chinese. So for some policy expert, he's sure having trouble determining the composition of Manchuria, isn't he, for someone who's extensively traveled there?
Well, he only cares about the politics. He doesn't care about the reality.
He was born and raised in Tianjin, China. His parents were English teachers at a Chinese university, so he spent most of his early life in China. And then he traveled all across Inner Mongolia. He traveled all throughout rural China.
Right, but his objective is to weaken China, right?
Absolutely. He worked for a British import-export related business. I have to wonder if it was related to opium.
That's probably run by the Sassoons.
It says that he worked first for a newspaper and then a British import-export related business. That's what Wikipedia says. Conservapedia doesn't have anything about his career, but I wouldn't doubt if he was working for the Sassoons.
They've been exporting and importing from China for a couple hundred years, right?
Oh, yeah. In 1940, Lattimore characterized Soviet policy in Mongolia as, quote, in the interest of the Mongol people as a whole, end quote. From Moscow in 1960, he was taken on an extensive tour of the Communist Mongolian People's Republic, towards which he adopted a completely uncritical attitude. Phil?
Yes.
I was wondering if that was something on your end. Okay. By the late 60s, Lattimore openly affirmed the position that the United States was pursuing an imperialist strategy as against the progressive stance of the Soviet Union. In all these books, Lattimore emphasized that Americans were reluctant to admit that the Soviet Union had any valid claim to be a democracy, quote, even when democratic procedures are as plainly stated as they are in the Stalin Constitution, end quote. Lattimore placed the three principles of Sun Yat-sen, Soviet collectivism, and the New Deal as all akin to one another. In the September 1938 issue of Pacific Affairs, Lattimore described the Moscow purge trials as a triumph for democracy, end quote, concluding that this orgy of mass murder, quote, sounds like democracy to me. We're getting a lot of complaints about the audio.
I don't know why.
Oh.
The view of democracy was actually in it would have been different in different people's minds at this period, right? But democracy was looked down upon by Americans well into the 1930s. I mean, the democracy was a propaganda. There was a lot of propaganda pushing this country into thinking that it was a democracy, the people in this country.
Sure. But even when you use the term democracy and then you talk about purges, even the most progressive populist type, you know, the Henry Wallace types, I'm sure they'd have a hard time wrapping their mind around how it's okay to purge 20 million people. You would hope they would anyway.
But if you look at the rhetoric of the Bolsheviks, and if you look at the pure meaning of the word democracy, you'll find a great similarity there, right?
Yes.
And a lot of people who utter the word democracy, to a lot of people, the word means different things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And today they use it in glowing terms, but the word was it was looked down upon by anybody that knew the principles upon which this nation was founded. The word democracy was a curse, and it still should be a curse.
Absolutely, we're a republic, and there is a difference.
There's a huge difference. But from the time of Woodrow Wilson, the propaganda was to convince the people of this nation that we are a democracy, and therefore that they're pushing us into communism, and that's exactly what they did.
And I found some interesting stuff here that ties in from Wikipedia to the Conservapedia. It says in the 1940s, Lattimore came into increasing conflict with another member of the IPR board, Alfred Kohlberg, a manufacturer with long experience in trading in China, whose visits to China in 1943 convinced him that stories of Chiang Kai-shek's corruption were false. He accused Lattimore of being hostile to Chiang Kai-shek and too sympathetic towards the communists. So it looks like that this guy's trade business in China was being hindered by Lattimore's criticisms of Chiang Kai-shek. So I wonder if Lattimore was originally working for some British Jewish merchant, and he ended up running afoul of this Alfred Kohlberg. Whatever the case was, he was assigned to help Chiang Kai-shek, and he routinely denounced Chiang Kai-shek here in the U.S., saying that he was corrupt and was pilfering U.S. aid.
The Stalin Constitution, it looks real pretty on its face, right? It calls for universal suffrage. It calls for right to work rights, and it looks like it's a working man's constitution on its face. You could have universal suffrage under the Stalin Constitution, but they don't tell you the part about there only being one candidate.
So your choices are Stalin or Stalin.
Exactly. They leave that part out.
And if you don't like that, your choice is a gulag or a bullet.
Well, that goes in with the right to work. You go to Siberia and work the mines, or you get the bullet.
And for your freedom of religion, you can be a Jew, you can be a Muslim, or you can be an atheist.
Right.
All right, to continue. In July of 1938, the IPR obtained a grant of $90,000 from the Rockefeller Foundation to perform a study of Asia. Dr. Edward C. Carter was managing it. Lattimore wrote to Carter, "I think you were pretty cagey to turn over so much of the China section of the inquiry to Asiaticus Heng Sen and Chi. They will bring out the essential radical aspects, but can be depended upon to do it with the right touch." Quote. Lattimore went on to say, "My hunch is that it will pay to keep behind the official Chinese communist position. And as for the USSR, back their international policy in general, but without using their slogans, and above all, without giving them or anybody else the impression of subservience." End quote. Lattimore recommended highly Challenge of Red China, written by Gunther Stein, a member of Richard Sorge's Soviet spy ring in Japan. Of Israel Epstein's unfinished revolution in China, he said, quote, "When he pleads his case, the arguments pile up like a wedge," end quote. When Lattimore resigned as editor of Pacific Affairs, he was succeeded by Michael Greenberg, a Communist Party member. I'm sure he was Irish. Lattimore then became a member of the editorial board of the notorious Amerasia magazine. Do you know what makes this magazine so notorious?
No, I don't. I could try to look it up.
Amerasia was involved. It was handled by Joseph Bernstein, a member of the Soviet GRU, the military intelligence official, and members of the Communist Party USA. So I guess that explains why it was notorious.
Well, what we've seen right from the 1920s, that it was the Moscow, it was the Bolsheviks of Moscow who were behind all of the communist uprisings in China. The entire communist surge in China was sponsored and financed and instigated by the Bolsheviks, by the Soviets.
Policy subversion. According to his Federal Bureau of Investigation file, Lattimore was suspected of engaging in espionage for a foreign power as early as 1927 while in Shanghai. Lattimore had been handpicked by the Comintern, quote, "to change the thinking here in Washington and in America on the communist activities in China in relations to the Soviet Union," end quote, testified former Communist Party USA Politburo member Louis Budens. Lattimore was thought to be a man who could put out propaganda and conceal a communist activity, but still have it carry out the policy of the communists, he said. The weight of his discussions was always along the lines of Soviet policy, according to Budens, but the language employed was non-Soviet in character, end quote. Alexander Barmine, former Charge des Affaires at the Soviet Embassy in Athens, Greece, advised FBI agents that then GRU, Soviet Military Intelligence, Chief General Jan Berzin referred to Lattimore in his presence as one of, quote, "the most promising young men that the Soviet military intelligence had," end quote.
Hmm.
During the Nazi-Soviet pact, that's the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact, Lattimore was added to Roosevelt's custodial detention index, listed as nationalistic tendency, communist. Later that same year, President Franklin Roosevelt appointed Lattimore U.S. advisor to Kuomintang Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek on a surreptitious and out-of-process recommendation of Lattimore's personal friend and patron at the White House. Roosevelt advisor and NKVD agent Lauchlin Kiri, while serving in this capacity, according to the Chinese military intelligence, Lattimore was sending coded messages to the communist Chinese rebels. So supposedly on the recommendation of an NKVD agent, who said that he would be a great asset to Chiang Kai-shek, they appointed him an advisor to Chiang Kai-shek. I'm sure Chiang would have rather done without the advice.
Well, certainly. I mean, right away, he's going to be working against Chiang Kai-shek. It's only natural.
Sorry, go on.
I don't remember reading anything about Owen. I mean, the names come up several times as we covered Alger Hiss. I don't remember reading whether or not Alger Hiss was the one that recommended him for the position.
I'm just shocked that the Chinese nationalists never had it occur to them that, you know, hey, this guy was here, you know, the Japanese started shelling us and bombing us, and oh, he's gone. Sorry, Roosevelt. Thanks for sending him, though. We really appreciated it when he was here.
I haven't gotten my finger on it yet. I've been looking I just wanted to be able to summarize it, but this Amerasia magazine was basically a pretty controversial topic in the era just before the McCarthy hearings, right?
All right. On November 25, 1941, 12 days before Pearl Harbor, Lattimore dispatched an anxious cable to Curie in the White House arguing against a proposed diplomatic understanding between the United States and Japan. When Congress later investigated the Pearl Harbor attack, U.S. Secretary of State Cordell Hull testified that he took a tough line with the Japanese because of this cable from Lattimore to Curie reporting on Chinese morale in the Kuomintang. This cable was the only documentary evidence Hull presented which influenced his decision to reverse himself and send the ultimatum to Japan. The use of harsh, demanding language toward Japan only strengthened the position of the war party in Tokyo. Japanese Ambassador Nomura found it impossible to reach an agreement because the U.S. demands were extreme. Professor Anthony Kubik has written that Lattimore, by this one act, designed to accomplish the Soviet objective of promoting war between the United States and Japan, did more to promote the Sovietization of China than in any act of his career. All Comintern designs for conquest of China hinged upon destroying Japan and the balance of power in the Pacific. Following Pearl Harbor, Lattimore became Director of Pacific Operations for the Office of War Information. In 1942, he and Curie tried to get a commission in military intelligence for Frederick Vanderbilt Field. That following year, Lattimore instructed Joseph Barnes to replace non-communist Chinese of the OWI with communists. OWI, Office of War Information, did so. On July 14, Thomas A. Bison in the Institute of Pacific Relations publication Far Eastern Survey referred to Maoist forces as, quote, Democratic China, end quote. This disinformation was widely repeated among journalists and academics. In July and August 1943, the Chinese Communist forces, in the midst of the war, joined with the Japanese armies to inflict a serious defeat on the Kuomintang allies with the United States. At President Roosevelt's request, Lattimore accompanied U.S. Vice President Henry Wallace on a mission to China in 1944 for the U.S. Office of War Information. During this visit, which overlapped the D-Day landings, Wallace and his delegation stopped over in Siberia and were given a tour of the Magadan concentration camp at Kolmaya, which Nobel laureate Alexander Solzhenitsyn described, dubbed the Pole of Cold and Cruelty, end quote. The Soviet government sent upwards of 1 million prisoners to Magadan for servitude in the hard labor camps of the Kolmaya. Writes Library of Congress historian David J. Nordlander, standing as the most notorious center of the Gulag, indeed as its capital, Magadan became synonymous with the Great Terror. According to ex-communist Marvin Liebman, one of the camp's prisoners, Eleanor Lipper, author of 11 Years in Soviet Prison Camps, told him of an incident during Wallace's visit. Suddenly, a woman from the ranks threw herself at Wallace's feet. She screamed in Russian how the prisoners were being treated, how they were dying, how they were innocent as the snow at his feet. Please, she sobbed, please help us. She was taken away, of course, while Wallace's translator told him that she was mentally ill and he could not understand what she was saying. I subsequently discovered that Wallace's translator that day had been Owen Lattimore. In a travelogue for National Geographic, Lattimore described the Siberian Gulag as a combination of the Hudson Bay Company and the TVA, gushing about how strong and well-fed the inmates were, and ascribing the camp commandant Felix Nizhikov a trained and sensitive interest in art and music and also a deep sense of civic responsibility. Solzhenitsyn wrote in the Gulag Archipelago that the city of Magadan was founded as a Soviet gulag and would not have existed otherwise. Commentator Cal Thompson wrote in 2007, while many Westerners recall Nazi-run death camps like Auschwitz and Buchenwald, few remember Soviet death camps named Kolmaya and Magadan. true, Alexander Solzhenitsyn mentioned them in the Gulag Archipelago, as did Varlam Slamyov in Tales from Kolmaya. But as the late Swedish journalist Andres Kuhn wrote, there are people who have still not heard of these communist extermination camps, even though the communists preceded the Nazis in creating such camps and killed an even larger number of people in their camps, end quote. And I'm sure there were no swimming pools, brothels, or movie theaters at the gulags, were there?
Well, right. The sad part is that the Nazis didn't have extermination camps anywhere.
Absolutely. And
only the Jewish Soviets had extermination camps.
And I'm sure the inmates
Where they exterminated mostly Christians.
And I'm sure they weren't allowed to grow their own food and put on plays, and I'm sure they didn't have a hospital, let alone
an orchestra, and their own money, their own brothels. Yes, Auschwitz had a brothel.
In 1944, Lattimore told Dr. Karl Wittfogel that the Emperor of Japan should be removed, and that as far as Korea was concerned, the best solution would be to let Russia take it over. Translation, let the Jews take it over. At a State Department conference, later, he submitted a 10-point program, which included recognizing the Chinese communist government, turning over Formosa and Hong Kong to them, and stating that no aid should be sent to Chiang Kai-shek. Yet this man was dispatched to be an advisor and an assistant to Chiang Kai-shek. And Hong Kong was a British possession, which isn't America's to hand over to anybody. And Formosa was directly under nationalist control at the time, wasn't it?
Yes.
That ultimately became Taiwan, unless I'm mistaken. In 1945, Lattimore published Solution in Asia. As the publisher's blurb on the book jacket states, he, Lattimore, shows that all of the Asiatic people are more interested in actual democratic practices, such as the ones they can see in action across the Russian border, than they are in the fine theories of Anglo-Saxon democracies which come coupled with ruthless imperialism. He inclines to support American newspapermen who report that the only real democracy in China is found in communist areas.
This is propaganda written right in Moscow, right? It has to be.
It sounds like some Jew wrote it and handed it to him, and he stamped his name on it.
Right. This is incredible.
But isn't this what we always hear, that America is such a flawed country, it's so much better in Cuba and Venezuela and Zimbabwe, where they have true democracy? There's that phrase again, true democracy, but we know what true democracy means.
Yeah, it means Arlene Johnson with her lips wrapped around some baboon. Did I say that? I'm sorry.
After the fall of China to the communists in 1949, then-Senator John F. Kennedy would blame Lattimore and his colleague John F. K. Fairbank for this tragedy. Mr. Speaker, over this weekend, we have learned the extent of the disaster that has befallen China and the United States. The responsibility for the failure of our foreign policy in the Far East rests squarely with the Truman White House and the Department of State, that's Dean Acheson.
Dean Acheson, we're going to talk about him before this series was over, but he was the great defender of Walter Hiss and continued all his policies. Dean Acheson, he had to be a communist.
Oh, yeah.
And he was another one of Felix Frankfurter's boys, one of the people placed in the State Department by Felix Frankfurter.
The continued insistence that aid would not be forthcoming unless a coalition government with the communists was formed was a crippling blow to the national government. So concerned were our diplomats and their advisors, the Lattimores and the Fairbanks, with the imperfection of the democratic system in China after 20 years of war and the tales of corruption in high places, that they lost sight of our tremendous stake in a non-communist China, end quote. Well, their stake was in towing Soviet policy line, and they wanted a communist China. So they obtained their stake, didn't they? They
secured
Absolutely. Their interests. They obtained their goals. Senate investigations. Lattimore was identified by U.S. Senator Joseph McCarthy as a communist and under party discipline. Former Communist Party member Louis Boudins corroborated McCarthy's claims and detailed how Lattimore had been of service to the Communist Party in the Amerasia case. In a unanimous report, the McCarran Committee classified Lattimore as a conscious, articulate instrument of the Soviet conspiracy. Lattimore wrote a letter of introduction for Hakun Chevalier, the KGB operative Lauchlin Curie. Chevalier was attempting to obtain a government job during this period of time. Chevalier is a known Soviet Secret Intelligence Service KGB contact and was associated with numerous members of the Communist Party on the West Coast. Curie also recommended Lattimore to President Roosevelt to serve as a special advisor to Chiang Kai-shek. Curie gave evidence in New York to a grand jury investigating Lattimore's role in the publication by AmerAsia magazine of secret State Department documents. In December 1952, Lattimore was indicted for perjury. Lattimore was indicted for perjury in his testimony before the McCarran Commission, but Judge Luther Jungdahl dropped the charges against him in 1955 on, quote, a purely technical finding wholly unrelated to Lattimore's activities, end quote. Legacy. Even on the left, many of the most knowledgeable observers agreed that Lattimore was a propagandist for Party Line. The socialist and ex-communist Granville Hicks, for example, was dismayed by the spectacle of liberals, quote, rallying with such absolute assurance to Lattimore's defense, end quote. Well, it's part of that exact same whitewash that they're doing for Alger Hiss and are going to continue doing for Hiss. They have to do it, don't they?
Right, and to show the extent of the communist network, right, in the Roosevelt administration, this Hakun Chevalier, he was at Berkeley. He was a translator of French writers into English, and he was a friend at Berkeley of J. Robert Oppenheimer's. J. Robert Oppenheimer was a Jew and a theoretical physicist, and he was the director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory. He was involved in the Manhattan Project, and he was a member of Communist Party USA.
And Hakun Maurice Chevalier, that's not really a French-sounding name. They said that he was born in Lakewood Township, New Jersey, which is a main home of Orthodox Jews. It has one of the largest yeshivas in the world. It's a historic Jewish community.
Yeah, well, with a given name like Hakun, I wouldn't confuse him for being French, believe me.
They said that it looks like his mother was Norwegian, his father was French, or at least claimed to be from France.
Probably
a Jew from France.
French Jew. Yes, that's what I would think.
All right. Quote, Lattimore defends every item of Stalinist justice, wrote unabashedly liberal partisan Arthur Schlesinger Jr. when Lattimore wrote that Stalin's great purges sound to me like democracy. Schlesinger commented that these words sound to me like fellow traveling. Lattimore got his views adopted by, quote, the entire body of respectable opinion, conservatives as well as liberal, on the Far East, end quote, wrote self-described former communist Irving Kristol. His ingratiating pseudo-Marxist platitudes became the stock and trade of all experts. Lattimore consistently and consciously undertook to do what the Soviet Union wanted done, wrote the former communist fellow traveler Diana Trilling. Though perhaps not a Communist Party member, she wrote, he was something far more dangerous, an ostensibly independent idealist whose idealism just happened to coincide with Soviet realism, although she said Russian realism.
Well, that same line could be used to describe Harry Hopkins, right?
Absolutely. Although Hopkins wasn't directly taking his orders from Moscow, was he, that we can find?
No, these things that Lattimore is saying here, they had to come directly from Moscow. In fact, let me talk about the AmerAsia affair real quick. Ex-communist Louis F. Boudens, former ex-communist, as if a Jew could ever be an ex-communist, former managing editor of the Communist Party organ, the Daily Worker, advised Federal Bureau of Investigation agents that Jack Satchel, a member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party, referred to AmerAsia as, quote-unquote, our paper. Boudin stated that Satchel told him the magazine was founded on orders of the Politburo, which appointed Frederick Vanderbilt Field, Philip Jaffe, and others in the communist cell within the IPR, which is the Institute of Pacific Relations, to direct AmerAsia. Vanderbilt testified that he had discussed with associates in the IPR the project of starting AmerAsia in 1937. AmerAsia was established with full approval of the Institute leaders. This property belonged to Frederick Field and Philip Jaffe, with Field holding the controlling interest. Field testified that he owned 50% of the stock, while Jaffe owned 49%. A good many of Field's associates in IPR were on the editorial board of AmerAsia. Field named Owen Lattimore, Kate Mitchell, Harriet Moore, T.A. Bisson, Benjamin Kaiser, a trustee of the Institute, and Philip Jaffe, who was also a member of the Institute and a contributor to its periodical. When Field made his effort to get into Army intelligence, it was in writing on the letterhead of AmerAsia, showing Field as chairman of the editorial board, with Owen Lattimore and William T. Stone as members of the board. There was no change in ownership of this magazine from 37 to 43 when Field resigned and Jaffe took over, so Field still owned it. There appeared in AmerAsia a long account which was recognized in General William Donovan's Office of Strategic Services as the verbatim reproduction of a government top secret document. The AmerAsia papers consists of documents seized by Federal Bureau of Investigation agents on June 6, 1945. Six persons, Jaffe, Mark Gain, Kate Mitchell, and three others who were U.S. government officials, Andrew Roth, Emmanuel Larson, and John S. Service, were arrested on conspiracy and espionage charges related to possession of over 1,000 stolen classified government documents. Let me continue. Documents from military intelligence, naval intelligence, Bureau of Censorship, British intelligence, the OSS, and the U.S. State Department were all confiscated. Among these documents were military reports giving secret information on the position and disposition of Chinese nationalist armies of Chiang Kai-shek. This resulted in the so-called AmerAsia Affair. Because the FBI had burglarized the offices of AmerAsia and the homes of several individuals, the evidence was deemed tainted. T.A. Bisson of the Board of Economic Warfare was also involved in AmerAsia. And there was a congressional investigation, and the outcome is that former Franklin Roosevelt intimate advisor Thomas Corcoran, representing several of the accused, was able to obtain reduced charges for some and have others dropped. The Truman Justice Department swept the matter under the rug. Now this is a Politburo newspaper, right? They funded this through these people.
Absolutely. And I mean, this is
an entire Moscow operation here. Service was restored to State Department duties. Jaffe and Larson received fines, and all the others were not prosecuted. Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin years later said that FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover believed he had an airtight case, and Justice Department officials were ready to prosecute. The case displayed every type of security breach imaginable and federal crime, theft of documents, policy subversion, cover-up, perjury, and obstruction of justice. McCarthy maintained it was a security breach and a cover-up of immense proportions. Well, it helped cost us China, right? The people involved in it did anyway.
Let me ask you this. If I were in the Soviet Union and I had 1,000 documents from six different agencies in my office, and the NKVD kicked down the door, seized all the documents, and my only defense is, hey, you didn't have a search warrant, you burglarized my office, is that going to get me very far? It'll get me all the way to Siberia.
Well, exactly.
And to finish up with Lattimore, Sol Levitas, editor of the socialist magazine The New Leader, wrote that Lattimore was worse than a spy. He was a literary agitator of the Kremlin who sought to harm American foreign policy by molding public opinion to favor a pro-Soviet course and was therefore more valuable to Stalin than 1,000 Communist Party members. Far from being simply a well-meaning liberal martyrized by McCarthy for telling unpalatable truths about Asia, wrote the socialist Sidney Hook, Lattimore, at the very least, was a devious and skillful follower of the Communist Party line on Asian affairs, who had more influence on American foreign policy in Asia than all anti-communists combined. As the American Committee for Cultural Freedom concluded in an article in The New Republic, Lattimore was indeed a willing instrument of the Soviet conspiracy against the free world, end quote. And that's basically what he was, an ideological agitator. Just like Bezmianov said that most of what is going on and has been going on, it's been done by Americans to other Americans.
Well, right, but if it was not for the placement of certain very influential Jews, and I think that this all started with and I'm going to try to establish that when we get on to discuss Harry Dexter White. There won't be time for that tonight. But Felix Frankfurter and certain other New York bankers, and Bernard Baruch being one of them, and they had an undue amount of influence in the Roosevelt administration. And that is, I believe, the beginning of the padding of the Roosevelt White House and the Roosevelt cabinet with all of these men who were communists or very sympathetic to communism.
And Conservapedia points out that Frankfurter, he had many proteges, Dean Acheson, Lee Pressman, Alger Hiss, Thomas
Morgenthau,
Corkin, but they list him as a former liberal. Well, I guess in the sense that he's dead, he's no longer a liberal.
Well, right. He put all these men there. It's not a mistake. This didn't happen by accident. He put all these men into the Roosevelt administration.
They claim that he moved sharply to the right as a Supreme Court justice. So what does that mean? He went from being a liberal progressive socialist to a neoconservative internationalist?
There's no doubt. Maybe he's one of the cutting-edge neocons. But,
he's a patriot because he approved of a decision that allowed allowed students to be expelled from school for refusing to say the Pledge of Allegiance. Well, that's a violation of your First Amendment rights. You don't have to say any pledge that you don't feel like saying.
Well, Christians don't realize it, but the Pledge of Allegiance is also a violation of the Christian covenant with God.
Since their allegiance is supposed to be to God, not to a central authority, a state government.
The founding fathers of this nation would not have stood for the Pledge of Allegiance. The Pledge of Allegiance was a product of the imperialism of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
I should call it the War of Northern Aggression, right?
When they made all the former Confederate soldiers swear an oath to the Union to get their civil rights back.
Well, James Madison, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, George Mason, Benjamin Franklin, John Hancock, John Adams, I could virtually guarantee that none of those men would have advocated a Pledge of Allegiance to a flag.
Absolutely not.
Your only allegiance should be to Jesus Christ.
Absolutely. They'd say that your allegiance should be to God, and your loyalty in terms of ideals should be to the Constitution, not to a flag that can change.
And I'm not going to pledge allegiance to a flag, never, and especially a flag that has a clown like Barack Obama representing it. I want nothing to do with that. I wouldn't piss on that flag if it were on fire.
All right.
I'd want nothing to do with that. Oh, okay, praise Yahweh, and we'll return with Harry Dexter White and possibly a cast of other characters.
Okay, so I'll see you in 2 weeks then.
Yes, praise Yahweh.
Yahweh bless. Thank you.